Aleichem Chaver, it's Binyamin Hammer, National Council Young Israel. Happy to welcome Rebbe, and we have conference call number 75. Thank you, Rebbe.
You're very welcome. Question one. A, may one use flavored floss, brackets, no hashkach on Pesach? B, can we rely on the various lists of cosmetics and shampoos forwarded by organizations that state do not contain chametz? So question one, strictly speaking, there should be no problem for a variety of reasons. It's not food. I'm told that perhaps all the ingredients are in fact kosher lePesach. In any event, even without hashkacha, where I came from, they always were machmer whenever it was not necessary to be mekel. So I thought that a person should get an unflavored floss for Pesach. That seems to be no harm done if he gets that, even though it's probably permissible, even if it's flavored. Second question, it seems to me that cosmetics and shampoos are both ein or royal achilas kelef. No one can eat it. Not, a dog wouldn't eat it. If it's ein or royal achilas kelef, doesn't need any hashkach. And therefore, the question is raised, can you rely on the lists of cosmetics and shampoos? The answer is certainly yes, because in all likelihood, it doesn't need hashkach at all, for the reason that ein or royal achilas kelef, even a dog wouldn't eat it. Question two. Is one supposed to leave his door unlocked or open on the Seder night? The Magen Avraham, Siman Tov Pei Aleph, and this is Cotton Bates, quotes the Ma'aril. Quote, Lo yino hadeles bebriya chazak, should not lock your door with a strong lock. Uveshchicha hezeka lo samchinen anisa. But if it's a situation where damage is common, then we should not rely on this miracle of Leil Shimurim, and we should lock the door. Clearly, depends upon the time and the place. It seems to me that in our part of the world, it's likely that we should lock the door on Pesach night. Question three. Zeichel HaMikdash Kehillel. A, is one supposed to say this before or after Korech? B, is one supposed to say the word Pesach, which is in parentheses? The Bir Halacha in Siman Tov Ayin Hey Sif Aleph, the B'maskel V'Omer, asks the question. Shulchan Aruch says, you say Zeichel HaMikdash Kehillel, it should be a hefsek. Shulchan Aruch there says, you should not be mafsik to eat the Korech so that the brachos of matzah and maror should go on the Korech. So how do you say Zeichel HaMikdash Kehillel before you eat the Korech? So he says, well, maybe the word Omer in the Shulchan Aruch is lav dafka. That's very hard to understand that could be so. He says Omer. But if you want to say the Omer and still a word about the kasha, the bi'alacha, the way to do it is to say the Zeichel HaMikdash Kehillel after you eat the Korech. And this way, you're okay. Now the bi'alacha writes, there's no mocher for the Mechaber's statement, the Omer, to say Zeichel HaMikdash Kehillel before they eat the Korech. The Dach Emoshe in Sukkot and Gimel says that you should, and other sources say it as well. And that is a minig, as the Piskei Tshuva says, and the explanation is given, it's not a hefsek because it's mein yona. Mein yona means it's relevant, like pass the salt before you between hamotzi and eating the bread. Even there, Poskim say it's better to avoid saying pass the salt. And it's interesting, the Piskei Tshuva quotes a precedent for the Mishnah Berurah Siman Tov Kuf, Tov Kuf Tzadi Beis, Sif Kot and Yud Beis, talking about the Hirotsons, which are sometimes said printed in the Machzor in the middle of the first Kiyas and Rosh Hashanah. But there too, if you look in the Poskim, they say, as the Mishnah Berurah says in that place, it's better not to say those Hirotsons in the middle of the Kiyas. Here too, it's better not to say it before you eat the Korech, but those who are lenient and save Zeichel HaMikdash Kehillel before the eat the Korech is no worse than someone who says the Yiratzon in the Magza. And here it's better for yet another reason. Some poskim say that the idea of Zeichel HaMikdash Kehillel doesn't mean that you're fulfilling the mitzvah of matzah and the mitzvah of moror in a different fashion. Rather, it's a different kind of a kiyum called Zecher LeMikdash has its own status. And if that's the case, it does not warrant the bracha. So the bracha would not go on the Koran. This is against the Mechaber, but that opinion also exists as an additional reason why it's permissible to say Zecher LeMikdash Kehillah before Korach. But I think the Medaktikim following the B'Halacha say it after Korach. As far as the word Pesach, well, depends who you ask. The Mishnah Berurah Sivkotan Chafalef has two opinions. According to the Taz, Sivkotan Tes, you say Pesach. Because Hillel did it with Pesach. Rashi says so in Pesachim Kuf Tes Vav Ben Aleph. The Chok Yachem and Sivkotan Yud Gimel says no. The Rambam seems to say only Matzah Mora. And not Pesach. And Al-Matzah Zomroam Yochlu, we understood in that fashion. And there's another reason he Chagal Yaakov suggests. If you say Pesach, a person may make a mistake and eat the Sar Tzli, which is a substitute for Korban Pesach, which you're not supposed to be eating. So therefore, for those reasons, he says you should omit the word Pesach, which is in parentheses. I think that most people do omit it, but those who say it clearly have what to rely upon. Question number 4. Is it proper to turn off the lights when doing Bedikas Chametz? Should one use a candle, flashlight, or both? So many turn off the lights, and it makes sense because the all our buzzer, both in the on-air, when there's no daylight. You want to have a time when the Nair does a better job. But in the Dirshu, in Tuf Lamed Aleph, footnote 6, says the Gedolim did not turn off the lights. He rattles off the Rav Moshe, and Rav Yashiv, and Rav Nissen Karelix, Rav Vosner, and the Chazon Ish, and the Stipula. They did not turn off the lights to their houses when they were doing Bedikas Chametz. They felt that it's better to leave the light on as well as using a candle. As far as a candle versus a flashlight, they quote the Rav Moshe says a flashlight is better than a candle, preferred. Rav Yashiv says a flashlight is permissible. Because a bunch of Gedolim who said, no, all on there is literally on there. They quote Shlomo Zalman and Rav Rosner and Rav Nissen Karelis and all and Rav Chacham Ben Tzion Abba Shaul went as far as they shouldn't even make a bracha if you're using a flashlight if you have no candle. It seems to me, at least in America, we should pass the Rav Moshe, the Morah d'America, Morah d'Asher of America, and especially, perhaps as Rav Moshe had in mind, to say it's better than a candle, people today are not used to handling fires. Like the old days, they didn't have electricity. They were used to, fire was everywhere. Today, we're not used to handling fires. And the sad proof is that when you have fires, they cause real fires. We had cases recently with Hanukkah candles and Shabbat candles. Not such recent history in our community. How much more so, they're freestanding menorahs in a safe place, what should be a safe place. How much more so, someone to take a candle, you have to go b'chor and stuck in, take the candle, climb under the couch, under the bed with a candle, chastinu could cause fire, could be a churban. And therefore, it seems to me you'll do a better job using a flashlight than using a candle, and I think that's the proper meaning for us, the Farav Moshe, to use a flashlight and not a candle. Question 5. If one is an elderly parent who has a Gentile aide, is it a problem to invite the parent and the aide to this house for Yom Tov? B. Similarly, is there a problem for a Pesach program to cook for Gentiles or non-religious Jews who attend? Would it considered Lifnei Iver to bring them along? So, in Siman Tov Kuf Yud Bei Sif Aleph, Shulchan Aruch passing, you're not supposed to invite a Nochri. Shema Yarbe Bishvilo. You may cook for him. It says Lachem V'lo L'Nachim. Ach Ashiyachal L'Chal Nefesh. L'Vadi Yassal Lachem V'lo L'Nachim. You're not supposed to cook for a Nachri. So they made a Gzeira not to invite him at all. However, it says in the Shulchan Aruch there, it was Avdo. Someone was an Eved. Lo Chash. Not worried about it. The Mishnah Berurah explains and Mishabur, this is caught in test, borrowing a phrase we just heard in the Megillah, that only for someone who's, quote, chafetz biyakaro, you have a distinguished guest who's not Jewish, and you want to raise his honor and esteem, so you may if asked, or even not if asked, cook extra for him, which is prohibited. But Avdo, it's not in that category. Therefore, they never made a gzera not to invite him. And it seems that our situation, the aid, is in that category. And therefore, there would be no problem of having the Gentile aid be invited with the elderly parent to come for Yontif. What about a Pesach program? I assume that means a hotel to cook for Gentiles and non-religious Jews who attend. So, if you look at the Dirshu there in footnote 10 in Tav Kuf Yud Beis, quotes that Rav Nissen Karelitz said it's usher, and the Stipler has a few possible reasons why it might be mutter. And if the cook is not Jewish, which often happens in these hotels, it's an additional reason to be more lenient. Now, incidentally, we mentioned non-religious Jews, and that itself is a whole question, what their status is. Some say if it's called mumor dino ka'akum, and therefore we have to treat them as non-observant Jews, as if they're not Jewish, for the purpose of not being able to cook for them. This itself is a question. And to compound the question, there are many who claim that Bisman HaZeh, in our world, nearly all the non-religious Jews are in the category of what we call Tinok Shenishba. They weren't brought up properly. Seems that this is a very good svara with respect to our situation. And therefore, it should be okay for non-religious Jews. There are those who say, what do you mean they're not the Tinok Shenishba? Don't they know we're screaming all about Shabbos and Shabbos and Shabbos? If you look on the Rambam in Perek Beis and Luchos Mamrim, you get an impression that someone who wasn't brought up properly, even though later on he is told what the halacha is, he doesn't take it seriously enough. He's already used to his old habits. He himself might consider to be a Tinok Shenishba, even though he later on became aware, and I think I should apply it to the secular Jews, even in Eretz Yisrael and certainly here in the United States. To cook especially for a non-Jew is not allowed, and that's why it's a problem if the guest does not tell the hotel owners they brought along a non-Jew, then they can ask a cook to cook a special omelet for them or a pancake for them on Yontif, and that would be a problem. And therefore, if you have a non-Jew in your company, when you come to this Pesach program, I believe it's incumbent to notify the kitchen that this is the case, and they should not cook for that individual during the Yomtif. Question number 6. Should one invite a relative who is currently not religious, was intermarried, but now is divorced, to a Seder in the hopes of igniting some sparks of Yiddishkeit in him? He has positive memories of Sedarim with his Zaydi. If yes, how exactly should one go about it, since he might not want to stay more than the first night? That's a very serious question. In my opinion, given this situation, there's a chance to bring him back to tshuva. You should invite him. Invite him to sleep by you for 2 nights and experience both Sedarim and both days of Yom Tov. If he leaves, he leaves. You can't help it. But you have to invite him to stay over in your house. And even if he leaves, is he really doing an Issur Melacha because of you? Can we say that, let's say, he drives home? He drove because of you, and otherwise he would not have been driving a car. He might be doing more Melachas. If he comes to your Seder, a Seder goes to quite a few hours, at least for those few hours, he's being saved from doing a Melacha. So therefore, it seems to me that you should invite him, but it's very, very important. You tell them you have to be in the house by, let's say, the New York City area, 7 o'clock the latest. You should get there well before the sun sets, because you would not want to have him drive to you on Yontif, especially this year it's on Shabbos. So you must come early, and you can pick him to shul, whatever you figure out how to spend his time properly in the most advantageous way to get him close to Yiddishkeit, whether it be in shul or in the house, but he must come early. Let's say he says, I can't. I can only come at night. I cannot come anytime until 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock. If that's the case, it seems to me it would be preferred to invite him to the second Seder. The second Seder. And tell him a late time, late enough that he should not have to leave his house before Pesach Kochavim. And the reason being that the second Yantav is more lenient than the first Yantav, and how much more so this year when the first Yantav is on a Shabbos. This way, you're minimizing the prohibition. And this, again, in a case where there's a decent chance to bring him closer to Yiddishkeit, I believe it's permissible. It's not carte blanche for anybody, just in this particular case and something like it, when there's a reasonable chance, based on his nostalgia, that he will be brought closer to Yiddishkeit as a result. Question number 7. A Baal Tshuva just met a relative who told him that their common ancestor's custom was not to eat gebrucks. He did not know this for years since he became frum and ate gebrucks, as was the custom of his Rebbe. Should he now take on this family custom? B. Is there any basis for one whose custom is to allow gebrucks on Pesach to refrain from eating gebrucks at Seder night only? Okay. The minig is found in Mishnah Berurah, Siman Tov Nun Ches of Katan Dalet, not to eat what's called Matzah Shiruya, which is what we call gebrucks. The word gebrucks means broken. They would break matzahs and then put them in their soup or their coffee. That's what's called gebrucks, means broken. It's not limited to broken matzah. This custom, you would not take a full piece of matzah and dunk it in your coffee either. That's what became known as gebrucks. So the Mishnah Berurah quotes this meaning, it says, strictly speaking, it's permissible. We're not afraid there'll be some flour which is not fully baked inside, which is going to become chametz when exposed to water. That's a very remote chance. We don't have to worry about it. It's interesting, if you look at there in the Dirshu, footnote 12, quote Rav Moshe says, in Chela Gimel Simen Samach Dalet, that HaToras Nedarim works. The person, the Nadi Gebrucks, he can do HaToras Nedarim, and in subsequent years he may eat Gebrucks, unless it's a Minig HaMakom. A Minig HaMakom is binding. No way out. And Shlomo Zalman there is quoted as saying the same thing in Halicha Shlomo, Pesach, Perek Dalet, Sif Yutes, and Sif Kotan Lamed, saying the same thing. Minig HaMakom is binding. And you can't get out. As long as you're a member of that Makom, then you're bound to follow the Minig of that Makom. Of course, the question is, Mizmanazer, what's the story? We know that in Europe, people lived in different areas. In some parts of Europe, they did not eat gebrucht. And in some parts of Europe, they did eat gebrucht. To some extent, it was divided along the lines of the Hasidim, the Nadi Gebrucht and the Misnagdim did. That's not completely accurate, but it's pretty close to being accurate. And there were different parts of Europe where these people lived. In the old days, the Hasidim lived in parts of Poland and Galicia and Lower Hungary. And the Misnagdim lived in Germany, and they lived in Lithuania and Upper Hungary. And these are obviously just broad strokes. It wasn't so segregated, but you could have a town of all Chassidim or all Misnagdim. This was very common in Europe. And if you were in a Hasidish town, you had to keep the Minig of Gebrucht. That's the Minig HaMakom, and it's binding, and there's no Ataras Adarim, and nothing works. We now live in America. In America, it seems to me, with rare exceptions, such as maybe Kiryas Yoel or New Square, but in other parts, maybe even Borough Park by now is in that category, there is no Minig HaMakom. The Jews from all different walks of life, maybe Williamsburg is in that same category. I don't know. There are a few Hasidic enclaves where everybody there, or the overwhelming majority, is from that kind of a background. So then if you live in those areas, and perhaps you should not be eating gebrucks because of Minig HaMakom. However, if you live in other, what we'll call mixed communities, where Jews come from all parts of Europe and are living there, such as, for example, I live in Riverdale, there are all kinds of people coming from all kinds of places. It seems to me that the Minig of Gebrucht is not a Minig HaMakom, because many, many observant Riverdalians do eat Gebrucht. So therefore, there's no Minig HaMakom. There are different customs and no Minig HaMakom. And therefore it seems that, strictly speaking, a person is not required to adopt the custom of the original family Minig, which existed in Europe. Because basically, you moved out. I know in my particular family, just as an example, both sides of my family, my fathers and mothers, were both from what we call Galicia, from Hasidic backgrounds. But my father learned in our yeshiva, what we call Litvish yeshiva, and when they got married, he did not accept the minhag of Gebruch, because I guess his friends in the yeshiva did not accept it. His Rebbeim didn't accept it. And so I grew up eating Gebruch, and we still do. Even though, go back a couple of generations, the family minhag was not to eat Gebruch, I assume. So in this case of the individual who was the Baal Tshuva, who discovers later in life that his grandparents or great-grandparents were not eating Gebruch somewhere in Europe, he's not bound to accept that minig, kavachomer, from someone who knew the family minig from the beginning. And Hataras Nadarim is permissible even if you did accept the minig, as we saw in Ramosha and Shlomo Zalman, how much more so for those who never accepted it in the first place. So I think it's okay for him to continue eating Gebruch. As far as the Leil HaSeder, if you look in Piskei Tshuvos, Siman Tov Ayin Hei Sif Kotan Yalav, he quotes such a minhag to eat Gebruch all Pesach except for the first night. What's the difference? If the Pashup Shat is that Gebruch is a fear that you're going to eat Chometz. Chometz is also a whole Pesach. Well, in some cases, they say that if you, certain kinds of Gebruch, the picture, let's say, for example, Knedlach, matzah balls. That's not just Gebruch. That's not like take a piece of matzah and putting it in water. To take a piece of matzah, put it in water, it says in the Shulchan Aruch Yotzei, matzah shruya yotzei. Because it softens it up a little bit, doesn't matter. But a matzah ball is made from matzah meal, which is completely, crumbled, and then it's cooked. Presumably, you cannot be yotzei the mitzvah of matzah with a knedel, because it's matzah mevushelas. You're not yotzei. So what? You already had the kazayas matzah. You even had a big shear kazayas of matzah. So what's the problem with a knedel at the seder? So the answer is given by some that the Rambam has a lashon in Hilchos Chametz u'Matzah, Perek Vav Halacha Aleph, Mishachol Kazayis Yotzah. So the Netziv, his commentary on the Shultas Nun Gimel, and my Rebbe said the same thought on his own, said the implication of the Rambam is that the more Kazayisim you eat, the more mitzvah you get. Mishachol Kazayis is Yotzah, that's the minimum. If you have 10 Kazayisim, it's a bigger mitzvah than 9 Kazayisim. On that basis, there were those who say the Netziv himself suggests you should have only Shmur Matzah on Seder night in order to be able to have more mitzvahs. We'll get to that. And on this basis, the Piskei Tshuvos quotes a custom, which quotes Rav Sternberg and Tshuvos Hanagas Chelik Beis Siman Reish Gimel, attributes to Rav Chaim Brisker, that he would not have Knedlach at the Seder, because he wanted to have whatever mitzvah, whatever matzah he was eating, he wanted that matzah to be kosher for the mitzvah, Mishachar Kazayas Yotzah, but have more. And they somehow considered it to be mevatel biyodayim, if you have knedlach. Most people are not worried about this minhag. You're not having knedlach because you want to be mevatel the mitzvah and say biyodayim. It's onig shabbos, simchas yontif, it's onig yontif. This year it's onig shabbos too, the first night. People enjoy knedlach. And there's no obligation to have, look, let's say for argument's sake, he does not eat a knedl. So that means he's going to have extra matzah. No, he's going to have the same 5 kazesim, whatever, 8 kazesim, whatever's going to have, add it all up. If you want to count the shear, it's probably having many more than 5, probably more than 8, probably more than 10. A real kazesim he's having between his matzah and his korech and his afikoman, you have a lot of matzah. So is there a mitzvah to stuff yourself with additional matzah during the meal? No, I never heard of such a thing. So the fact that he's having a knedel as opposed to having carrots in the soup, what's the difference? Either way, he's only X amount of matzah. So they call it mevatel mitzvah sasebi yadayim because you're having matzah, but it's not kosher matzah. I don't think that's necessarily so compelling. I think most people have a minig that they will eat knedlach even a Seder night. Question number 8. A couple shared with me that their minhag is to eat non-gebrachs over Pesach. However, found their family minhag, they do eat matzah milk for breakfast. Is breaking a matzah and placing in the milk gebrucking? Well, literally it's gebrucking, you break it up. However, there's a couple of reasons why this minhag may exist. Again, if you look there in Siman Shulchan Aruch, Tafnut Ches, you look in the Dirshu, footnote 13, he quotes a custom that says, oh, we're really afraid that there's some unbaked dough or flour in the matzah the flour is going to turn into chametz. So they say that if the total number of minutes that the matzah, from the time the matzah is put into the water, the time it's eaten, is less than 18, so as many poskim say, there's no shir chimutz. There's no shir chimutz. So you take matzah, you dunk it into water, and you eat it right immediately. There's clearly no shir chimutz. Others say another reason to be made, because only machmir by water, because water is machmir, so it certainly can cause chimutz gomer, as opposed to milk. Say chicken soup is mostly water, okay. But milk is milk. It's not water at all. Another reason why there's some who are makel, for those who have that custom, they should keep it. Question 9. How can and how would one kasher a warming drawer for Pesach? This is a broader issue. There is a type of kashering which is known as libun, when we're talking about absorption on fire, not with a medium of water, libun. And libun, real libun, is that when the turns white hot or red hot, which is between 700 and 900 degrees, clearly you cannot do that for your warming drawer, you'll destroy it. And the question becomes, can you rely on a different type of libun, which is called kibolo kach polto, that the same temperature that the chametz may have come in to that surface, you heat it to the same exact temperature, and it will go out. If you look in the Sefer HaGolos Kalim, page Tuf Mem Hey, they quote from Rav Henkin and many other Gedolei Poskim, that although we try to be machmir, not to rely on kibolo kach polto, but to insist on the higher level of libun, when food touches that surface, because that's a strict halacha, there's much more room for leniency when the food did not touch that surface. You're worried about some zeya, some steam, things of this nature, and there's what to worry about, yes, but there's more room to be a makel in that kind of a case. This could be relevant to a regular oven as well. You put up to the highest, it should work, Quanta Rav Henkin and others. It should certainly work when it comes to a warming drawer, which is not as hot in the first place. So I believe if you put up to the highest temperature, this should solve the problem. We assume that, generally speaking, the food did not touch the warming drawer. It's in some other receptacle. Now, if it's the case where it's you know for a fact that you put the food straight on the surface, which would be a rarity, I think, or maybe things spill, then you have a problem. It may not work to kasher in that fashion. We'll perhaps come back to it a little bit later. 10. Is there any basis to a minig that to only shmur matzah and only foods made from shmur matzah meal for the duration of the entire Pesach? Well, if you look in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Tov Nun Gimel Sif Dalet, he says you should be somewhat careful about shmur. We call shmur mishas ktsira. But the word shmur means that all matzahs are shmur. But when you use the word shmur colloquially, I assume it means shmur mishas ktsira. Okay, and that's only necessary for matzahs mitzvah, the first kazayas. The Mishnah Berurah writes, Enef Sifkon Chof Hei, in Tov Nun Gimel, that there's a minig to the entire of Pesach to be, what's called Mishas Tchina. even though it may not be necessary, technically speaking, but that is a good minig. The Bialacha, the Maskel Tov, quoted the Vilna Gaon, kept Shmur Mishas Ktsira for the entirety of Pesach based upon his interpretation of the Rambam. That would be a legitimate basis for such a minig to eat only Shmur Matzah all the entire week of Pesach. Some have the minig and many don't. Question number 11. When signing the actual Shul's Chametz, who signs the Shtar Mechira and makes the Kinyan with me? Me means the rabbi. The Shul president, its board of directors, to all the members need to be informed. What is the community Shul considered in Halacha? The Shul has a preschool program with a separate board. Do they need to sell the Chametz in their room separately from the Shul? Very, very good question. Very good question. Seems as follows. Whoever has the right to represent the members of the shul has the right to sell the chametz of the shul as well. And therefore, it seems the president, the gabbai, they can sign the authorization form to authorize the rabbi to sell the chametz. Not necessary to tell all the members. Enough, that's what representation means. You appoint the president, the gabbai. They're the ones who take care of things for you. The shul is probably treated like a shutfus, a partnership of its members, and therefore, whoever is authorized by the partnership to do the selling of the chametz, which is presumably the president or the gabbai are the ones who are given this ability, they're the ones who should authorize the sale. But the rabbi should sell the shul's chametz to a guy. But if there's a separate entity known as a preschool program with a separate board, they have to sell separately, of course. The fact that they happen to be housed in a shul doesn't matter. Question 12. Can one kasher their countertops and sinks, assuming that they are made of material that can be kashered, for Pesach using a steamer that exceeds 212 degrees? So a steamer, steam, according to most authorities, cannot be equated with boiling water. And therefore, it seems to me that you should not use steam to kasher countertops and sinks. Let's read 13. What is the practical way to kasher sinks and countertops? So 12 and 13 go together. Nonetheless, if you look carefully in the Sefer Galos Kalim, page Resh Chav Ches, based on the Prichodesh, Yerodeh Simon Kuf Chav Alas of Kotten Tetzvav, he says, you do apply the principle here of Kabbalah Kachpolto. If it comes in with steam, it goes out with steam. And he says that the only time we're strict not using steam on page Reish Mem Aleph is when it requires Hagola Mi'ikar Adin. It really requires a kashering for sure. When it's only a chumra, perhaps we can rely upon steam. It seems here, with respect to a sink, which requires Hagola kashering Mi'ikar Adin, you should not use steam, even though it's 212 degrees, because it came in with boiling water. But with respect to the countertops, one could argue that strictly speaking, they don't even need a kashering at all. Why? A rule in Yerodeya. Ein belua yotze mikli lekli bela rotev. That absorbed food, which is absorbed in a pot, would not go from the pot to the countertop without a medium of rotev, of liquid. According to the Chavos Das, means a significant amount of liquid. The Yad Yehuda disagrees, but Chavos Das is a significant amount of liquid, which you presume we don't have in our case. There is a problem of spilling. Things can spill. Things spill, so we said before that we should not rely upon steam, because things spilled. They could have been very hot when they spilled. It seems to me that as far as spilling is concerned, if you know it's things spilled, you have to pour water there. You know, I have to be careful not to ruin the woman's room. If you can't, then you should use steam, better than nothing. Cover it, which is certainly better than nothing. And be careful and patient not to spill anything. Take extra precaution. It seems to me that in most homes, they cover the countertop whether you're kashrut or not. It's a chumrah which women have taken upon themselves. And once you do that, there's really no real need to kash in the first place. If it's covered, that nothing can get through. What about a sink? So we said that steam itself would not work for a sink. So what do you do for a sink? Well, since a sink absorbs what we call in our language irui mikli rishon, a person can take a pot of noodles and pour the water straight from the pot into the sink. That's irui mikli rishon of real chametz water. They cook noodles in it. So kibola kachpoto, he went in with irui, it comes out with irui. That means you should take a pot full of boiling water and pour it on all the surfaces. Now here's a problem. The floor of the sink is a little easier to get to because it's a limited surface. You have to pour all around it. And it seems to me that you take a big pot of boiling water, you can probably cover the entire floor of the sink with that one pot. You just move it from place to place, in the different directions, across and down, et cetera, to make sure you've done the best you can to cover the entire floor of the sink. What happens if you started pouring, and as we know, water seeks its own level, and water covers the entire floor in a flash, and now half of the sink, when you pour the water over it, there's intervening water separating the water you're pouring out from the water, from the actual floor of the sink. It seems to me that's not a problem for a variety of reasons. One, when I pour the second pouring, if you will, second half of the pot, I'm emptying out over the first half. So I believe that the water in this, which is in the sink already, is given a status of iwi as well, especially if the water is pouring out. It's just all one big flow. It should be much less of a problem. In addition, the reason why iwi does not work all the time is because of the cold surface in the bottom. Tatog over here, the surface has already been heated up. So therefore, the pouring should work. The problem really is, in my view, it's very difficult to pour the water over all the sides, the walls of the sink. How do you do that? It's very hard because you have four walls and you start throwing taking the pot and aiming it at the walls. It's no guarantee you're going to hit every spot, and the hardest wall is the wall closest to you. Because if you don't be careful, the water is blowing out, you get hurt. So how do you cover all these areas? So we try our best. But in my house, since I'm not sure I can get all the water by pouring it directly from the pot, what I do is I stuff up the sink in advance with the drain. I just turn the drain so the water stays. Take three big pots, and I first pour the first pot, try to get all over the floor of the sink. And then the next pot, I try to get the sides of the sink. And again, as I told you earlier, in my view, especially in the case where the water remains in the sink, because you close the bottom, all that water, when other water from a clevision is being poured on it, continues to maintain its status as irimi clevision. It's not considered clicheni, because it's still connected to the water which is coming from the clevision, as well as the fact that the water on the bottom is very hot. So therefore, that's what we do. After the pots are done, I take the hot water tap and put it on just to fill up the sink to the very tip of the top so that all the surfaces are covered in hot water. It is true that the hot water in the tap is not as boiling hot as the water which came from the pots. However, if you have three big pots, Depends how big the sink is. The water is still, when I'm finished, it's still steaming. Steam is still coming up, which may be the equivalent for our purpose of roschin, of boiling water. In addition, when it comes to Iri, you look at Mishnah Brura, you get an impression it's enough to have what's water, even Yatzel lettuce bowl. You need roschin when it came in on a fire properly, in a clearishin, but in Iri, there should be enough Yatzel lettuce, which it certainly is, even at the very end. Question number 14. Shabbos morning shachas begins at 8:45 a.m. We have lost some mispalim to a neighboring shul that has hashkama minyan at 8 a.m. So we have not lost their membership. It is noticeable that the minyan is thinner. The congregation is asking that we explore what to do to win back these members. The choices are A, having our own hashkama minyan in the chapel starting after Pesach at 8 a.m. B, changing the time for the main minyan to 8:30 with brachas at 8:20. Is it better to stand up for the main minyan and perhaps speed up the completion of davening? Right now, a typical Shabbos, you finish davening at 11:15. Perhaps with time management of Mishaberos and shortening my drasha to 10 minutes, we can finish by 11. What is the right direction to take here? I have absolutely no idea how to answer this question. Depends upon all the dynamics of this shul and the neighboring shul. It's impossible for someone without knowledge to even give a good advice. I'll say one thing in general, and if it applies in this case, so be it. Hashkama minyanim are now much more popular than they used to be, and they pull mashkimim, people who can't sleep. They like to get a hashkama, they're already up for a few hours before sometimes. Or those who are drawn to the charm of hashkama minyanim. It's usually less formal. Usually the rabbi is not as present. Somebody's not present at all. And people like that. Very difficult to overcome these tendencies. Very difficult. To compete with the neighboring shul? Or a fan that has a kind of a business model to compete with another shul? Doesn't sound to be the right thing to do. If the people like Ashkama, let them go to Ashkama to the different shul. Again, if there's a demand of sufficient nature in your own shul to have Ashkama, fine. Many Ashkamas, such as mine, started, there was no room in the main minyan. Once the Ashkama begins, so then it takes a life of its own. I believe that to avoid a Hashkama minyan being considered a completely and totally separate entity, that the Rav should appear at Hashkama minyan. In my Hashkama minyan, I speak almost every Shabbos before Kriyas HaTorah. They start 7:30. I speak 8:20 or so after Shachas before laning. It's not as if I don't have a presence there. And at times during the year, we don't have any Hashkama. Since Hashkama was originally founded because there was no room upstairs. So the times of the year, in a few weeks in the summer, we'll call them Ben Azmanim, after Tisha B'Av, there's no Ashkama. Yom Tov, there's no Ashkama. The only Ashkama Yom Tov minyan we have, not discussing Shavuos, where everyone dies at 4 in the morning. The only Ashkama we have is on Sukkot because of traffic control. It's hard to fit everyone in. Other than that, on the other Yom Tov, we don't have Ashkama. So what happens? Some of the people from the shul, whose main loyalty is to our shul, come upstairs. And some people whose loyalty is to just have an ashkama, not do it our shul, they go to a different ashkama. Fine. I think that's the best way to handle such a situation. But I should add one more note. I'm not sure if the question lives in New York area. I strongly recommend that the main minyan should daven at 8:30. At 8:30. You don't have to say brachos at 8:20. 8:30, even with brachos, if you do quickly, it's fine. Why? Because now, if you start at 8:30, you can finish, you can make Zman Kriyashma, as we call it, every single week of the year. Before that existed, they used to change the clock much later, end of April. We would daven as early as 10 to 8, even before our many Hashkama Minyanim, because we wanted to make the Zman Kriyashma. It caused a bit of a stir, but I think it's the right thing to do. Remember, during the week, people are davening at 6:30 or 7. So 10 to 8 is late. People should get used to them making Zman Krishma, even with the brachas. I think that's the proper custom. So I think everyone should start at 8:30 to make Zman Krishma all year long. And that's the proper thing. And this way, if you don't make it any shorter, you will finish at 11 o'clock. From 8:45 to 11:15 is the same thing as from 8:30 to 11. And if you want to finish earlier, you want to start 10 minutes early with brachas, you can finish maybe 10 to 11. Marshall, usually we start after we finish before 11. It's a general rule. People don't find it to be so difficult. It's still an early start and an early end, relatively speaking. That's how, again, I'm speaking just in general terms because the particulars of the neighborhood and the other shul, I do not know. Final question, 15. My shul is charged a bounced check fee by its bank and in turn charges it to the congregant whose check bounces. One congregant claims we held on to the check too long, about 3 weeks, before depositing it. He should not be responsible. Is he right? I don't think he's right at all. People often hold on to checks for 3 weeks. The bank honors checks 3 weeks later. He should have been careful. The fellow wrote the check that there's enough coverage for this check to clear 3 weeks later as well. And if he was not careful, then on a simple level, he's obligated to pay based on what we call Dina Degarmi. He caused a loss to the shul. If you look in the Sefer Pischei Choshen, Nezikin, Pere Gimel Ha'ara Samach Gimel, he thinks Yechai Medina Degarmi, there are all kinds of particulars and details, but on the simple cases described here in this question, I believe that he should be paying the shul for its loss. Frankly, even if he were not chayav, if we call it a grama, he's part of medina adam v'chayav medina shemayim. So, especially comes to a shul, he should make sure that they do not lose any money based on his mistake and having the check bounce. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rebbe. B'zrat Hashem, will be calling upon Rebbe again in 2 weeks before Pesach, and Mitzvah Hashem, we'll get together again. Thank you very, very much. Take care, everyone. Bye bye. Thank you.